ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to The Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm Tom Charpentier, Government Relations Director here at EAA, and your host today, my guest is...
I'm Chris Henry, the EAA Aviation Museum Manager, who I'm usually one of the hosts, but today I get to be a guest.
Yeah, Chris, so why is that? What are you here today to talk about?
So I would like you to buy this meat that I'm selling. No, I'm joking. So normally, as you guys know, when we have a guest, our guest a lot of times is here for the speaker series. And unfortunately, we had a guest, our F-14 Tomcat pilot. He had an unfortunate passing of someone close in his family. So he had to reschedule, and I filled in. And by the way, he is coming back. That Tomcat pilot is our January speaker, so he'll be coming back to join us. So I filled in with a story that I really wasn't quite ready to launch, but it was a last-minute fill-in, and it really got good reaction. And I said, well, you know what? Typically, the speaker would get a green dot time, and maybe we should talk about this. And that is a little bit of background about the MASH project I'm working on.
Yeah, so so you have been developing a presentation on both the TV show and the real life MASH units. I guess we could probably start there. I mean, MASH is kind of something that entered a term that or an acronym that entered public consciousness with the TV show, but probably, I would say, a small minority actually knows what it even stands for. So what do we, why don't we start there?
Absolutely. It has nothing to do with potatoes, which a lot of folks think. But what it stands for is a Mobile Army Surgical Hospital. And how it came about is very interesting. In the trauma world, the golden hour, how you treat a patient in that first hour after an injury occurs, has a very, very big impact on how their outcome is. And I mean, this goes all the way back to, you've heard the stories of, you know, the advancements of medicine, but you go back to like the Civil War, you know, where it was like, if you got nicked by a bullet, you died, you know. But in reality, if you were injured in the Civil War, you had something like a 13% chance of surviving that battlefield injury. And little by little, with the advancements of medicine, those numbers grew. As far as the survivability rate. However, even when you got into World War II, a World War II battlefield injury, you still only had about 50% chance of surviving that battlefield injury. It's better than 13%, but that's still not great. And along the way, there were different surgeons who were working at places like Tokyo General, who were serving in stateside administrative areas, who were able to say, you know, I think we should put things like battlefield hospitals or medics and things like that. And that's where you saw these numbers increase. But it wasn't until a surgeon at Tokyo General that sort of came along with the idea of, hey, you know, we had to make this sort of aid station sort of set up because of D-Day. D-Day actually led them having to decide, oh, how are we going to treat our wounded on the beaches? We don't have hospitals there or anything like that. And after World War II in Tokyo General, they said, you know, we really ought to think about putting surgeons closer to the battlefield. And then that even led to one step further, which was, what if we made these hospitals somewhat mobile, somewhat crude? However, they're really close to the front lines. When the front lines would move, these hospitals would move. These hospitals were sometimes between 1 to 5 miles from the front line. That really comes in key into to something we'll talk about here a little bit later. And now you also have the advent of the helicopter. So now you have not just ground ambulance, but you have the helicopter, which is first on scene. You know, the first time they're really using it in a big way. I mean, they used them at the tail end of World War II for a little bit of stuff out in the China, Burma, India theater, but you now have the helicopter, the H-13 or the H-19, you know, really in a battlefield area, able to get the wounded from being wounded, going to an aid station, and then being flown to a MASH unit within an hour. You're at actually a hospital getting operated on, and the hospital would do life-saving surgery. It wasn't pretty. They called it meatball surgery. But they would do the surgery to save your life and then patch you up and then fly you to somewhere like a hospital ship or Tokyo where you would get maybe some more extensive surgery. But their whole game was save your life close to the battlefield and get you stable and then get you to somewhere else that can do anything heavy that has to happen.
So when you said Tokyo Generals, was that kind of the main surgical unit during the Korean War?
Yeah, that was your big hospital. That was where you would get major, major stuff done. And then they had hospital ships also that would do the same thing.
Okay. So basically it was kind of a convergence of a number of different factors, the battlefield experience of World War II and then the advent of the helicopter that kind of, that allowed for this kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Can you describe some of the, of course the helicopters are a big part of the visuals on the show.
And,
of course it's a big, as you said, it kind of made the whole thing possible. But this was still, only, less than 10 years after the first fielding of a helicopter in combat. What was that like for that?
So the helicopter was in its infancy yet. I mean, so for the most part, the two or three types, they had a Sikorsky, and then they had the Bell H-13s, which, the Bell H-13 or Bell 47, that was the iconic image that you see in the beginning of the TV show. So you're talking about a helicopter with a Lycoming engine in it, big bubble canopy, and then the steel tubing tail that goes all the way back. You're talking about really, this is not a military helicopter. I mean, we're talking about a civilian helicopter that has been turned into a military vehicle. But they performed wonderfully. And as a matter of fact, when you think about it, the MASH units and the aviation air rescue squadrons, like the 3rd Air Rescue, people like that operating in Korea, are literally the foundation of the air ambulance and stateside, medical evacuation that we use today. That all started with the MASH units in Korea. That's where that all was born and proven. These helicopters were very lightly built. There's no armored. There's no weapons on them. The H-13s flew with one pilot. The Sikorskys had a pilot and a medic because they were a little bit bigger. And that was it. I mean, this is a very thin built aircraft, both of them. You're not looking at something that has any sort of weapons on it or anything like that. And certainly not a Black Hawk like you're used to seeing today, or even a Huey. This is not that. This is a very light airframe.
Yeah, that's one thing that always stuck with me was that kind of like the early ambulances. Of course, the early ambulances, I think they were literally hearses that were converted. You stuck a stretcher back there, and they were kind of on the patient was kind of on their own until you got to the hospital.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the same thing for these helicopters. You're basically just strapping stretchers to the skids, right?
Yeah, yeah. The old Model T ambulance. Ernest Hemingway drove one.
Yeah,
wrote Farewell to Arms about that. So, this is that, and it's something I found out in my research was I always, they strapped stretchers to the side and they had a little windshield to kind of, shield you from the wind. One of the things I didn't realize is because I was always like, wow, if a patient kind of flips out, there's nothing you can do. They're out there. Well, here they actually sedated the patients in those stretchers.
That seems smart.
Yeah, it's probably a great idea. You'd probably have to sedate me if I was going to fly in one of those.
Yeah. Out on the skid? Yeah, yeah, probably.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I got to fly with Joe Norris and the Bell here in two summers ago. And you'll never watch that TV show the same way. So if you're coming to Oshkosh and you want to go fly in a Bell and you're a MASH fan, it's a cool experience.
Maybe we should start selling rides on the skids.
Yeah, we could. We could. We could see what Joe thinks about it. Yeah.
All right. So, what drew you to this project? I know you've done a lot of different military history projects. Why MASH specifically?
Well, it's really funny. I never planned on doing this, mainly because I knew friends of mine are going to be like, dude, you have loved that show your whole life. What are you doing? Next is the Dukes of Hazzard, lecture that I'll give, But what happened was it kind of fell into me little by little, or I kind of fell into it, I guess. So we had a tip that there was a pilot named Richard Kirkland who was alive out in Washington, D.C. yet, World War II vet, who had flown P-38s with Richard Bong. And we were like, wow, this is cool. There's not a lot of P-38 pilots left, certainly not a lot of guys left that flew with Bong. Our P-38 is painted up as Marge, and we're like, we should go out and record this with him interview with him if he's willing to do it. Because, going down the road, we can do exhibits around it. Just the information he would have that he'd be willing to share. So we went out to record the interview and talked to him in his home for like an hour about flying P-38s and his experience. And we get done, and I'll never forget, we turned off the lights and we actually were starting to take apart like the extension cords and stuff like that. And I was just making small talk with him, and I said, what did you do after the war, you know, and after you got back? And he goes, well, I qualified for jet fighter training. And that's the pinnacle, right, of military aviation, to fly fighters. And he said, I was at training, and a guy flew in a helicopter. And I had never seen one before. It was a new technology, really. We're talking right after the end, shortly after the end of World War II. So he said, I wanted to go for a ride. And the guy said, sure. Well, I didn't know at the time that my squadron commander hated the helicopter. And when I got back from this ride, he said, I saw you go for a ride in that. I'm going to fix it so that that's all you fly. And he had me transferred to helicopter training. And I went on to fly helicopters in the MASH units during Korea. And my buddy, full well knowing that I was in the MASH units and into the TV show, immediately just starts unraveling the extension cord again to plug the lights back in. And he was like, all right, let's ask about MASH units, and he told me this wonderful story that if you're a fan of the show, you can almost see. He said, I flew my first flight, and he says how it worked is we went to the helipad, and my squadron commander at the 3rd Rescue said, I'll fly the first flight, see what's going on. I'll come back. We're going to hot seat. You're going to jump into the cockpit. I'll jump out. You take the next flight. And he said, he landed, and he got out, and he says, you're going to fly north along this river for about a mile or two, and then you're going to see a big tree knocked down. And he goes, you're going to take a left turn at that, go back like 500 yards, and the aid station's right there. And he goes, and that's it. He patted the side of the helicopter and walked away. Like, that was my briefing. First flight ever in Korea. And he goes, I'm flying into a battlefield. And he said, I went up, landed, and picked this guy up. And when I picked this guy up, the guy at the aid station said, he's really in bad shape. When you get in the air, radio the MASH unit and tell them that you need a surgeon to meet you on the helipad. And he said, okay. And he said, I did that. And in my head, I hadn't really met anybody at this MASH unit yet. And he goes, so in my head, I'm picturing the surgeon to be out there in a white lab coat and a stethoscope. And he says, and when I go to land, there's a guy in a Hawaiian shirt. And he says, well, are you going to get a surgeon? Because I thought he was like an orderly. And he says, I'm the chief surgeon. And he looked the guy over and said, go, prep him for surgery. And he said, are you new? And he said, yeah, it's my first day. And he says, well, it's nice to meet you. They call me Hawkeye. And who he had met was actually Richard Hornberger, who wrote the book, which the whole, show and the movie was based off of. And that was at the 80-55th MASH.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty wild story. So, and there's a lot of this along the way. I mean, the thing that I think is funny is I am a huge fan of the show, and I was almost shying away from doing this just because I am such a huge fan of the show. But I'm really glad I've done it because I've learned so much more, and the show really is more than I ever thought it was. So it's been pretty cool.
Yeah, so the I know that on the show, about how far from the front line was a MASH unit usually stationed?
Right between 1 to 5 miles. I mean, it was.
So they must have moved a lot. I mean, the front line shifted quite a bit in Korea.
Yeah, it was always kind of funny, like, because the show kind of depicts it. It's one camp, right? It's right. A set. They don't want to move it.
And like what? Maybe once a season, they
right.
They,
there would be an episode about bugging out or whatever, But if you look closely, it was just the same set,
Yeah.
But yeah, MASH units moved a lot. And then later in the war, they started to slow down with the moving. They didn't move quite as much. But early on, they were moving a lot. And something, I said we'd get to later. Is their proximity to the front lines. So you're talking 1 to 5 miles from the front, right? And that front's moving.
Right.
And for really one of this country's first times, we are putting women right in the combat zone. I mean, women are serving between that front line. And, we've had women serve in World War II, but, they were generally like people like the WASP who did an amazing job, but we didn't really put them in harm's way in combat. These women were in combat. I mean, they were right there. And so because of that, All of the nurses at MASH units were all volunteers, every one of them. You could not be assigned to a MASH unit as a nurse. Where the doctors and orderlies and things were draftees in many cases, this country had actually hit a very low number of military health professionals. So there was a huge draft. So a lot of the doctors, something like 80% of the doctors in MASH units in Korea were draftees. And they were drafting them straight from like residency and things like that.
Yeah, but, I know that's where Hornberger, he had just gotten out of medical school. And then got drafted. Was that unique to Korea or did that happen in World War II too?
I think World War II was just a much different war. I mean, like, I'm sure that they did draft them, but I also think World War II, there were so many people in line to go.
Sure.
You know, that was just different. This was a first. So you had this combination of regular Army doctors that were already there and were very Army and military, and that was their career. And then you had these draftees that suddenly are showing up and are not really used to folding blankets or hiking or marching or saluting. I mean, and that, you know, the show touches on that obviously a lot, but that's what they were getting at, is these guys were not – they were doctors wearing military uniforms basically.
Or Hawaiian shirts.
Or Hawaiian shirts and – yeah, exactly.
Very good. Very good. So as you went through this project, you know, you tend to get some pretty good well, you already had one very interesting interview subject. Who else did you talk to?
So along the way, Richard Kirkland was awesome because, I mean, that was really a big aviation tie into it. And, you know, we think of, you know, probably like how many medical helicopter pilots were there, right? When you see these documentaries or shows, you think there was like a whole bunch. And at the end of the day, it was a really low number. And I don't want to give the wrong number, but it was like under 100 like MASH pilots ever. I mean, it was a very small number. Wow. So to get the chance to actually interview one was really special. I got to spend time with some of the Drake family. So the Drakes actually met at a MASH, at the 8055th MASH, which was pretty cool. And then their daughter, who's just a wonderful ambassador of their story, really helped spend a lot of time with me, share pictures, which was really fantastic. There's actually a MASH documentary, The Real MASH, and they were really wonderful about sharing a lot of stuff with me to sort of fill in the storytelling that I want to do and the lectures that I do. And they had a lot of the Drake photos, original color slides they shared with me from Korea. And then two that I never thought I'd get. And because the talk is heavily focused on, of course, the real MASH units and what really happened. But you can't talk about it and then not talk a little bit about the show, because that I'm a firm believer in that show really is how so many people know about what Korea was or that it happened. You know, if you think about it, Korea just never got the spotlight that like World War II or even Vietnam got. They call it the Forgotten War for a reason. So something to think about, you know. A couple years ago, they made Devotion, the movie about Jesse Brown, Tom Hunter, and the Corsair during Korea. Prior to that, the last aviation movie made about Korea was The Bridges of Toko Ri.
Really?
Yeah.
Which was made during Korea.
Yeah. The last movie about Korea overall, other than Devotion, was MASH in like 1970, I think.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's just crazy. So I did want to get a few cast members if I could, or at least some comments. And I never expected to get to actually ask my questions to both Alan Alda and Loretta Swit. Loretta Swit I just talked with last week. I don't think you can talk to either of those two people and not be changed. They're just so wonderful ambassadors of that show, of the veterans, of the stories that they tried to tell. And it was really a big learning curve for me, because I didn't realize just how much truth was in the show. About 80% of the storylines for the show came from interviews with real MASH veterans, and they were trying to make sure that they told their stories. Just really amazing things, you know, like Alan Alda wearing the same pair of boots for 11 and a half seasons that belonged to someone who was lost and their family, friends in Vietnam.
Wow.
Dog tags that they wore. They would wear dog tags from fallen soldiers, and the families were mailing in the dog tags to the show, and they would actually wear them on the set. They would never wore their own dog tags.
Huh.
So just little things like that to pay tribute to them. Loretta Swit told me that, you know, I think the big thing to talk about with her is early on, if I'm talking to anybody that loves the show, and hopefully I am, you'll notice that, you know, early on her character is nicknamed Hot Lips. And that actually comes from a real nickname from a nurse at the 8055th MASH. She always would wear bright red lipsticks. They called her Hot Lips. And probably about the second season, she didn't really like what her character was doing. Her character, you know, was very one-dimensional, if you will. And she wanted to make this more in-depth. And they hired a woman writer for her part especially. And she met with a nurse who actually had served in Korea at a MASH unit. And she said, you know, I just made up my mind right then and there. And I told everybody on set, I need to become the best damn chief nurse out of any MASH unit in Korea. That's what my character has to become. Because with my character, we're honoring all of our women veterans, not just the ones that served at MASH units. We're honoring all of them. You know, and remember, MASH was on during Vietnam. And we had nurses working at Vietnam hospitals as well. So it's really amazing to watch her character evolve from sort of Hot Lips into Margaret, which I think is a huge, huge deal when it comes to honoring our women veterans.
Yeah, wow. So you're adding to your impressive list of A-listers that you've interviewed, but that's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. It was really cool.
So this is something interesting about the MASH TV show is that it's a show about Korea, but it really was kind of a commentary on Vietnam.
It was.
And yeah. And how did that interplay work?
Well, I mean, I think that's a very good question. I mean, as a society, they were facing issues, right, that we were seeing, and they had to be you know, early on, I think there were a lot of people who wanted to be more Hogan's Heroes.
Mm-hmm.
But the country wasn't at that point. We didn't want another Hogan's Heroes. And they said, you know, there's real serious issues we could talk about. And it wasn't, you know, the movie was very anti-military. It's a good movie, but it was an anti-military movie, right? The TV show, and I think at some points, you know, folks maybe feel that it was anti-military and some feel that it wasn't. I think what it was a real look at what was going on in both Korea and Vietnam. I mean, and to be honest, it carries through to a lot of different conflicts. Anybody that served in the military could tell you that, you know, there were moments where you were like, yep, that's right, you know, or anything like that. I mean, and it was really interesting to hear, like, for example, my dad was a Vietnam vet. My dad did not talk about Vietnam ever. I mean, hardly ever. He told me like a few funny stories. And he did not watch the Vietnam movies, but he watched MASH.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved MASH. Like, he never missed it. There were really interesting stories of, you know, it made you think. It wasn't just, and I'm not bashing Hogan's Heroes because that's a funny show, but it was deeper. You know, I mean, it was funny, but then it was sad and it was serious. But I think a lot of people who have served in the military say, like, well, that's what it's like. I mean, there are really hilarious moments that happen when you're deployed. You know, it's not all funny, obviously. There's a lot of sad and serious. I mean, but so at the end of the day, you know, yeah, I think they were dealing with issues that we were seeing in Vietnam. But I think that doesn't mean it didn't happen in Korea. It just wasn't talked about, you know. And I think they were, you know, one of my favorite episodes was, you know, they showed Hawkeye crying after his friend died. You never saw the leading man of a show cry.
Mm-hmm.
That just didn't happen at that time. You know, the leading man was tougher than nails, and, you know, and your hero is crying because his friend died. Something you just never saw. Something else that they did that I thought was interesting was they killed one of their main characters. I mean, to give you an idea, when Henry Blake, their commanding officer of the unit, died, the year before, he won a Golden Globe. I mean, so that's a serious actor on your show. And he had been offered another show, always thinking that, like, well, if it doesn't work out, I can come back to MASH. And the writers decided that, you know, we always said we were going to be true to the experiences that these people served and an experience, and not everybody came home. So they actually had a different script written. They did the OR scene, and hopefully I'm talking to MASH fans so they kind of know the scene that I'm talking about. But when they were done, they thought they were done for the – it was a season finale. And they said, hey, we have one more short thing we have to shoot. And they relit the OR scene. And they brought Gary Berghoff, who played Radar, in to – and it was at that moment, you know, just a few moments before they gave him this short line. They had to come in and say that Henry Blake's plane had been shot down and Henry had been killed. And that was a season finale. And they just kind of panned to the OR and everybody's got tears in their eyes. And the most of the cast, all of the cast, none of them knew. A couple of them knew just right before the shot. And literally it was only like Alan Alda. Loretta Swit did not know. So like when that came on, none of them knew. It was all just real emotion. And if you watch it, it's really interesting because somebody, it's very quiet. They just keep working. Somebody drops an instrument. And it was really funny because Alan Alda has said that the sound guys were bothered by that and they wanted to go back and reshoot it. And they were like, no, this is like this perfect somber quiet broken by somebody dropping an instrument, you know, because maybe they're crying or nervous. And the amount of mail that they got, hate mail, for doing that was a large amount. And it was really funny. The cast of MASH said, we are going to reply to every letter that we get, and we're going to reply by handwritten note. And really what they had sort of come together to say was that you're not mad at the show for killing Henry Blake. You're mad at the war. The war mm-hmm. killed Henry Blake, you know, and you should feel that way. Those letters are actually archived. They're at the Museum of American History at the Smithsonian in D.C.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, they actually saved the swamp set and the OR set when the show ended. And again, that's something that show was so big and so part of American culture that the Museum of American History stepped in and said, we need to preserve so much of this. I mean, it's kind of remarkable.
Maybe some of the letters back should be like, well, in 40 years, there's going to be this network called HBO that's going to have a bunch yeah, of shows where nobody's off limits.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Little did you all know what was coming, you know? Yeah.
No, that is interesting. I mean, the show definitely was ahead of its time in that regard.
Yeah.
And you're right that, you know, I think it, there is definitely a commentary about the reality of war, and it asks some very tough questions, but I think it does it in a very respectful way. One thing I was also thinking, this has got to be one of the few pieces of media about war that where the main characters are mostly, aside from the nurses, the main characters are mostly draftees.
Yeah, there probably wasn't a lot of that. You're right.
Which gives kind of a different lens to that. You know, I think like Band of Brothers, all volunteer unit, right?
Right,
you know,
exactly. And all the Doolittle raids. I mean, these guys are all volunteers. And I guess it was. This is probably one of the first where you're talking to a lot of draftees a good way of putting it is you have people who are draftees next to people who are career military.
Right.
And how they interacted with one another. You know, and it's interesting because, there's just so many interesting stories. For example, at the 80-55th, was a surgeon by the name of Dr. Appel. He had actually, him and some of the other surgeons, they got tired of sending people home with missing limbs. And that was really weighing on them. And they actually found a procedure, they discovered a procedure that they could do, which was an arterial graft. They actually, Dr. Appel went into town, into Tokyo, and he actually had on leave the clamp made. He had drawn up a clamp that he thought that if we can make it, we can do arterial grafts. And they had it made in the field and started doing these procedures. The Army, believe it or not, had a list of procedures that were approved that you could do in a MASH unit. And of course, this graft was not approved. And, you know, they had to decide. This is the other hard thing. If you have a room full of wounded bleeding out there, you can't do this procedure because it took an extra half hour. And you might save this guy's leg, but that cost this guy's life. Mm. However, if with proper triage, they knew that, hey, you know, we're not going to lose anybody if I spend an extra half hour on this patient, we could do this procedure and actually save a limb and send somebody back with, you know, all of their limbs, which is a win, right? So they started doing it, and the Army actually threatened court-martial. And they said, if we come and find you doing these procedures, we're actually going to court-martial you, which you're talking to a bunch of draftees who didn't really care. I mean, they're in a MASH unit, you know, a mile from the front line. So I mean, it was kind of funny, but and now we do that. That procedure is standard procedure. I mean, it became a standard procedure. And oddly enough, Dr. Appel did not get credit for his clamp. Somebody else back here copied it or made one and then copyrighted it. Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty amazing. Something else is something Loretta Swit told me that I never realized is, by the way, Loretta Swit became the first cast member civilian to go and visit Korea. She actually went to Korea, which is pretty wild. I say the first civilian cast member because of all people, Jamie Farr, who played Klinger, served in the military and actually was served in Korea. Alan Alda also was an Army veteran. He served an Army unit as well. But something she kind of shined a light on that I never thought of is, you know, a MASH unit, it's technically supposed to be out of harm's way. Geneva Convention, you're not supposed to shoot at a medical unit, you know. However, the top three killers in Korea, the top three ways to become wounded or killed in Korea was literally frostbite, snake bite, and then combat. So these MASH units were fair game to the top two of three. I mean, you're talking about nurses, everybody living in the top two of the three ways to lose your life in Korea. So they were certainly right down in it with everybody else.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Getting back a little bit to the aviation angle, since we are an aviation podcast let's talk about the helicopters a little bit more. So you talked a little bit earlier about kind of how these guys navigated, which was going to be one of my questions because, you know, I've seen the cockpit of our Bell 47. You know, it's got a couple of extra radios that wouldn't have existed during Korea, maybe a GPS unit, but back then, I mean, it was basically all VFR flying. Mm-hmm. Was that the way that it was generally done for evacs? Is that you'd fly to like the kind of the combat aid station right at the front line?
You would have an aid station or somewhere you were supposed to go, and a lot of times you knew the unit and you knew where they were, but those aid stations would move around too, and they would have a grid, you know, you would or like a sector that you would fly to, or you would get the fly up the stream and then look for the big turn down tree. Now I'll tell you a couple interesting stories about that though. Is, you know, the helicopters couldn't fly at night. Mm-hmm. That just wasn't a thing, you know, at this point in helicopter aviation. And Richard Kirkland told me a story that there's a lot of FARs about to get broken, just so you know, Tom. I know this might make you uncomfortable.
Don't worry. There's no FAA in Korea in 1950. So
they did indeed have a still in their tent, which was actually named the Swamp. That was Hornberger's tent. You can actually, if you really want to go deep, you can Google it, and there's actually some pictures of the Swamp in 1952. However, it did have a still in there, and they were drinking martinis, and it was nighttime. So at nighttime, you knew you weren't going to fly, right? So you can have a drink. And they got a call from an aid station, and they said, you know, that we have a guy. He's not going to make it if we can't get him out of this aid station and get him some help. And it was Richard Hornberger that had asked Kirkland, is there any way of getting this guy? And, you know, he said, boy, it's nighttime. We don't do that. And he says, this guy's, you know, honestly, against operational control standards that we would actually have now on medical helicopters, he said, this guy's not going to make it if we can't get him. And Kirkland said, well, I figured I should try. And he goes, so I put down my martini and I walked out to my helicopter. And I'm like, that's awesome. That's a phrase you don't hear a lot, right? And he took off and he said, well, as he was walking out, he goes, I don't know how I'm going to find these places. You know, there's no instrument approaches to a MASH or anything.
Right.
And they said on the aid station side, they were going to light a bonfire. And they had the idea at the MASH unit for him coming back, they were going to take all the Jeeps and put them in a big circle and turn the headlights on. And so he kind of knew his heading, and he said, I took off, I got to the aid station, I got the guy. And he says, we're flying back, and the sky just lights up with any aircraft fire. And he goes, I have no idea where it's coming from. I have no lights on this thing, so I don't even know how they saw me. And he goes, and all I could think about, and as the helicopter's bouncing around, he goes, this thing must be getting torn to shreds, you know, because there is just so much, all these tracer rounds out there. And he says, and I somehow get out of it. And I find the Jeeps in the circle at the 8055th, and I land. And he said, the next morning, I didn't tell my squadron commander I was going. And he said, the next morning, the commander said, I want to see you. and we walk out to the helicopter, and all I can think about is this thing is probably shot to pieces and I'm in trouble. And he says, we get there, and here it was all in my mind. There wasn't a single hole in this helicopter. It was fine. And he said, I know you went out last night and you got that guy. And he goes, never do it again. And he said, okay. And he goes, but it was a hell of a mission, wasn't it? So, you know, the other story I like to tell from the dedication of those helicopter crews that were going out there was that they got a call from same thing. Wounded helicopter went out in daytime. And in the while he was doing this, this pilot got his radiator. It was hit. And so he was leaking all his coolant out. So he can only fly for a short period of time and it would overheat. And it took him like a day and a half, but he just kept, he would fly for as long as he could. He'd land, let the helicopter cool down, tend to his wounded and see, make sure he was okay. Then he would go out, walk ahead and find the next landing site. And he'd walk back to the helicopter. And by the time he got back, it had cooled down enough. He would fire it up and then fly to that next spot and then land and just keep repeating the whole thing over again. When he flew at night on a few hops, he actually flew with a flashlight in his mouth. Because there was no lights in the cockpit of these things, and he eventually did get his wounded to a MASS unit and save the guy's life, and I believe he was awarded the Medal of Honor for flying. So I mean, the foundation of what we call the dust offs in Vietnam and the crazy rescues that we saw in the Jolly Greens, their lineage goes back to those pilots flying in the 80/55th and the dedication they had to get their wounded out of the harm's way.
Yeah. Definitely. And they did a little bit of this with fixed wing during World War II as well, right? I think L5s were modified.
Yeah, L5s and L4s and stuff. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, to be able to get them right in, a helicopter, you can just drop right in on the battlefield is pretty handy.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's really the stories of these guys. And then the weird EAA ties that would hit. EAA has, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, EAA has this strange magic. You know, when I worked on the B-17 program, putting vets on, you know, you would just get – there's no better term for it than magic. You know, you'd pull into town and you say, boy, I wish we could find a B-17 vet. And then this B-17 vet would come out and be like, oh, I flew 35 missions. And, you know, we'd put him up for a ride, you know, and get these cool stories with him. And this is the same way in many regards. We get a call the one day and it was interesting. It was – it was actually had nothing to do with MASH. We were talking about the Breezy. And Robert Unger, Carl Unger's son, had come out. Carl Unger was, of course, the inventor of the Breezy. And Robert still flies them. And he came out, and we were just looking over the Breezy. We were doing some preservation work on it. And somebody had mentioned in passing, one of the staffers, you know, like, oh, you know, you're going to do your MASH lecture, you know. And he's like, you're going to do a lecture about MASH? And I said, yeah. And he goes, oh, you know, my dad flew helicopters at MASH units. And we're like, what? And he goes, yeah, he flew an 80/55th. Like, and he goes, do you want to see, like, pictures? Do you want to use these pictures?
Oh, my gosh,
and,
really?
Yeah. Huh. And we're like, what? Like, what world is that? So, we got all these wonderful photos from them of him with the, you know, Bell H-13s and stuff like that. And then he goes, you know, my dad actually built a model from scratch of an H-13 while he was at the MASH unit, and we still have it. It's like trench art almost, and it's, you know, it's big. It's about, you know, it's a good few feet long. And he goes, you know, do you think that would have a home here in the museum? And I'm like, yes, you know, absolutely. And it's out on display near the Korea exhibit right now.
Wow.
And it's a really cool piece of EAA trivia. Along the way, I found out that the gentleman who played Frank Burns was a home builder.
Huh.
So, you know, Larry Linville was an EA guy and built his own gliders. And I had no idea, you know, that was out there. So really wild turns of events. Same thing. I had another gentleman come in and said, you know, my mom was in a MASH unit. Same unit, oddly enough. There was only seven MASH units in Korea, something like that. There weren't a lot of them. He gave me scans of all of his mom's color slides. And they're beautiful. Captures that she got. And then, you know, I've actually talked to folks who served later at MASH units, like in Vietnam, there was a MASH unit. And then they had to change the tactics around, but MASH actually survived even through the first Gulf War. And then shortly after the first Gulf War, they went to more of a tactical combat hospital, which we have today. I talked to a woman who was a nurse at a MASH unit in the Gulf War. the wildest story she told me was she pulled Scud duty one night. So they were supposed to sit in a Humvee and watch the sky for Scuds at night while everybody was sleeping. And she said, I see a Scud go off. And, you know, I call out to everybody because you're supposed to get your chemical warfare gear on and everything, right? And she said, well, there was a Patriot missile system right there, and the Patriot took out the Scud. But it was so close that all of the raw fuel from the Scud splashed my entire Humvee. It was all wet with fuel from the Scud missile. So, I mean, it's been a really wild adventure with this. And one, I'm really thankful that I did. I'm thankful EA just kind of allows me to work on things like this. But it's worth preserving. You know, my favorite story that Alan Alda had mentioned was that, you know, there was the story that he had been told, and several of the cast had been told this similar story, was that when these guys went away to war, they were young. And when they came home, you know, it affected them. The war had changed them, their demeanor, their sense of humor or views. And MASH was something that was able to allow the veterans to show their families and say, this is what it was like, you know, and this was a very real taste of that. You know, fun fact, when the show ended, it actually is to date the highest rated ending of a TV show. And it's actually right behind, the only thing that outdoes it is the Super Bowl from 2010 on. That's it. That's the only thing that has ever topped MASH is the Super Bowl, only from 2010 till now. And it's interesting. It's a skewed fact because they had MASH watch parties for this finale. So all they'd count was the number of TVs that were on. They don't really count how many people were actually watching, right? So there's really, the number is kind of unknown as to how many people watched that finale, but obviously a lot of people were vested in it. So it's really cool. This is just a wonderful thing I've been able to do here, and hopefully I'm doing some good for you know, the veterans who of any age, but you know, and shedding some light on a group of veterans who maybe don't really get talked about too much. I mean, MASH went off the air in the mid 80s, so you know, it's never a bad thing to talk about Korea. Talk about the nurses, and then talk about the aviators who were really putting it out there to go save lives. That they're pretty special people for sure.
Yeah, it is a very unique story, and certainly certainly the cultural you know, tie into the show, but of course the show was highlighting something that was very interesting, unique story of a war that we don't remember too much, unfortunately. So
yeah, and I'm forever indebted to the families of the vets who shared stories, photos, the vets themselves. Obviously, Alan Alda for being willing to answer my questions, and Loretta Swit for probably the most fun hour and a half I've had in a very long time. Just really, really awesome people who care about preserving those stories and really truly care about what they did. You know, they knew that it was more than just a show. It was way deeper than that, and it's something that they're still very proud of.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chris, this project is still ongoing, right?
It is.
So if anybody listening has any stories of either the real life MASH units or the show that they want to share with Chris, they can contact us here at EAA, and we could get you over to them. So yeah, thank you so much for coming on, Chris.
Absolutely, absolutely.
He's given his presentation now already for the Museum Speaker Series, but I'm sure a webinar is coming at some point.
Sure I have to, and then I'm actually going to do it. People have asked because it wasn't planned, so we never marketed it, and people were like, "I'd really like to come and see it." So I think August of 25, I'm going to do it again in the Speaker Series lineup here.
For awesome! Okay, yeah. So we got that to look forward to as well.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely.
Well, Chris, thank you for coming on as our guest this week.
Yeah.
Share your research and your project with us. For those of you listening, of course, keep the reviews coming and let us know how you feel we're doing. feedback@eaa.org is our email address there. You can certainly rate us on your favorite podcast platform. We have the Museum Speaker Series is available. The schedule is available online on any of our social media or our museum website. And with that, Chris, thank you very much. And to everybody else out there, we'll see you next time when you are cleared to land on the green dot.